You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In David Mitchell's 2004 novel Cloud Atlas, six separate stories, each set in a different time and place and each written in a different style, combine adventure, love, suspense, and humor with philosophy and science fiction. The book was a finalist for the Man Booker Prize and was highly praised for being inventive and original. Dave Eggers calls it a modern classic, and that's one of the reasons that we chose it as this month's Leonard Lopate Show Book Club selection. Cloud Atlas is published by Random House. It's now available in a paperback edition. And there's, of course, this film version, which is about to be released on October 26th, all of which makes me very pleased to welcome David Mitchell back to our show.
Thank you very much.
And we also hope that you, our listeners, have been reading the book. And if you have a question, you can leave it as a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or give us a call at 212-433-9692. So can you talk about how you first conceived this novel? How did you come up with the idea of writing six stories in different genres that would all add up to tell one story?
The original idea was a sort of pole vault from another book. The other book was a book written in the 1980s by Italo Calvino, one of the postmodernist Italian novelists, called If on a Winter's Night a Traveller, where a sequence of stories get interrupted and never picked up again. I enjoyed it, but it kind of left me frustrated. And for years, I wondered what it would look like if you tried to put a mirror at the end of the book so that actually you do go back and pick up the discontinued narratives. So the book is sort of kind of a stereo. The first half, introductions or part ones, and the second part of the book, part twos, and just that and a combination of youthful impetuosity, sort of, why not? Let's see if it could be done. What would it look like?
And you had a lot of time on your hands. But one reviewer actually described it as being structured like a palindrome.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we move forward, we go to the, far into the future, and then we move back again.
That's a very good way of describing it, and from now on, I will also describe it like a palindrome. It's an accurate description.
Did you have any specific influences for each story? Did you model the characters or voices on other works as well?
The voices, yes. Perhaps the voices more than situations. The 1850s section, I combed through Melville, through Moby Dick, which is a wonderful excuse to reread that magnificent whale of a book. In the 1930s, I don't know if you know the Anglo-American composer Frederick Delius.
Of course,
and
he becomes a character practically.
He does, yeah, yeah, indeed. He was an elderly, dying composer who was sort of musically locked in until a young amanuensis persuaded the composer to let him be his assistant, That man was called Eric Fenby, and he left behind a fine memoir which had some scenes that I loosely borrowed.
Although you've called the composer Vivian Ayres.
Yeah, that's right.
Delius.
No. Students of both Delius and Vivian Ayres would be able to find more than a few things in common. Moving into the present day or the recent past, there's dollops of Three Mile Island and sort of Alex Haley type airport thrillers in from the 70s for the 1970s section. And moving into the future, the things we've all imbibed. There'd be trace elements of Blade Runner and future sci-fi dystopian classics like that. Metropolis, maybe. And then in the far future, when civilization has fallen and the people on Hawaii have no knowledge that there's any other land on Earth apart from their small island chain, we can find other examples of this in literature too and film.
Now, writing is very difficult. Were you having fun doing this,
or was it
really as difficult as it seems to somebody who has struggled trying to write a little fiction?
Well, there's two kinds of difficult. There's fun difficult and despairing difficult, and it's a matter of when you're running up against a despairing difficult, then it's usually because you're doing something wrong or at some key point haven't been honest enough with yourself about the viability of an idea you're very proud of but can't bear to jettison. Once you do, then it can become fun, difficult again. So you sort of feel your way forward like that.
Although the themes of this novel are not fun. It's about slavery, about civilization and savagery, about predator and prey. Is that about right?
That's a very good description of the major themes, Leonard.
Yeah. Big topics. Why did you want to tackle them in a novel? Or did they just come along as you were having fun?
Yeah. Well, I'm not a non-fiction writer. All I can do is write novels, which sort of limits my mode of expression in the first place. Some writers start out with the themes, other writers find them as they go along and slowly work out what the story is about or allow the story to reveal its themes to the writer. And I'm certainly much more of the latter than the former. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's the way I wrote the book. It sounds a bit of an abdication of responsibility to give you this answer, but the answer is that that's what the book wanted to be about.
At a certain point, you realize you wanted to talk about slavery, not just in the past, but also our potential for doing that sort of thing again in the future.
The name changes, but it's always with us in one form or another. I mean, look who made our clothes. That's pretty close to slavery in whatever sweatshop in Indonesia or China we bought these shirts from. You know, it never really goes away.
Did you write these stories in their entirety and then break them up later?
Precisely. But I did know where the sort of the cliffhanger moment would be arriving. So I wrote them in there in entirety, and then about an hour before I was due to email the manuscript to my editor, I used that magical paste and copy facility on my computer, and just that was my post-production, which the directors of the film hate me for because they spent 9 months doing the post-production, whereas I took about 20 minutes.
Well, that's one of the nice things about working on a computer. Many writers hate computers because they can move stuff around as easily. They like the idea of just writing things out in longhand on yellow pads. Not you.
It might be a generational thing. I've had laptops since I was not quite knee high to a grasshopper, but since I was in my 20s, and I can't start on a laptop. I can't attack a blank screen, that stays blank. I can attack a blank piece of paper or find ways in through paper in a way I can't find a way in through a screen. But fairly quickly, I like to transfer onto the magical laptop. Yeah.
David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas is this month's Leonard LoPage Show Book Club selection. We invite you to get into the conversation by giving us a call if you've read the book at 212-433-9692. Or you can also go to our show page at WNYC.org and leave a comment. What's the setting of the central story and what was once, I guess, Hawaii?
Yeah. Well, as you say, we're in probably about the 24th century. Oil dried up a long time ago, and the civilization, our civilization that floats on oil, also sank. The English language has also evolved and arguably decayed, so people are speaking a kind of rough pidgin mixed with Hawaiian slang, mixed with the kind of mistakes that my students would make when I was teaching English in Japan. And it's a fairly barbaric time, just set amongst the last literate tribe of Hawaii that still know how to read and write and use books.
And it allowed you to kind of invent a language.
Yeah, yeah. That was fun. It's easier than recreating a language that once existed, because, of course, you can get that wrong. In my last book, I had the experience of trying to recreate 18th century English, and that's quite a tall order because it already exists. Whereas if you're making up your own, then all you have to be is internally consistent. It's far easier to invent Esperanto than it is to learn Mandarin Chinese.
That section reminded me a bit of Lord of the Rings. Is Tolkien an influence?
Yeah, yeah. As with many writers, I think I read him when I was a kid, and I've just finished reading Lord of the Rings with my 10-year-old as well. He's a great world builder. I mean, here and there you can maybe pick flaws with the style when he sort of slips into the Cod Arthurian. But who cares? He imagined that world so intensely and its mythology that it ends up convincing the reader.
And there's a great deal of suspense and adventure in the book. I assume that's something you like as a reader. You mentioned Melville. I would imagine Conrad also.
Yeah. Oh, I love Conrad. I love Conrad.
So this is to some degree a homage to the people who have you've appreciated as a reader.
You could say that. Possibly fueled by envy. Sometimes as a writer, people talk about inspiration and creativity. Where you get your ideas? It's sometimes no more ennobling than this sort of visceral urge when you look at something and you sort of burn and you think, I want to do that. I feel that with both Conrad and Melville.
One of the stories is the Louisa Ray mystery. Was that named after Thornton Wilder's novel, The Bridge of St. Louis Ray?
Well spotted, Leonard. You've done it again. Not surprised, but...
that was one of the books in my father's library when I was growing up.
Oh, it's a hell of a book. It's a great novella, great novella. Louisa Ray actually appears as a phone-in caller to a radio station in my very first novel. And I got the name from The Bridge of St. Louis Ray at that point, but... Two books later, I was sort of interested in who she might have been, and so I gave her her own major role.
A listener, Ray, from Harrisburg, Virginia, left this message. Do you think that this book has a fundamentally negative view of humanity, or is it ultimately hopeful?
Hello, Ray. Thank you for your question. I think it's fundamentally hopeful, but for hope to feel convincing, it needs to... Be outlined by anti-hope, by despair, by negativity. It's the dark parts of a painting that actually make the lighter parts brighter. So there are generous helpings of both. But I think the last line is fundamentally positive.
This and your other novels have been described by some reviewers as being difficult, but that's praise, not a criticism. Do you set out to write difficult books?
Oh, heavens no. No. I mean, I just set out to make the book work. That's the biggest question I ever think about, really. Once I begin to feel that a book is being deliberately difficult for its own sake, then I very quickly get impatient with it. I like plot. I like character development. I like these basic forms of propulsion that novels have. Now, ideas are also forms of propulsion, and I want them in there in the same way that bread needs yeast. But I think bread shouldn't taste of yeast too much.
But you also said earlier that plot develops as you're working on something. So do you have little sense of where you're going to be going while you're working on each of these individual stories?
It's like a road trip through the alphabet. I know I start at A, and we'll be ending up at Z or Z since we're here. And I know I want to go through G, M, P and T, but these being scenes or ideas or pieces of dialogue or characters I want to bring in, but how I will get from D to E, I often don't know until I get to D, even though I know I'll be getting to G at some point later on.
So you kind of have a sense of where you're going to end it. You just have to get there.
Yeah. And I have a sense of a few of the way stations, the motorway service stations on the way.
A listener, James from Brooklyn, has asked a question that really doesn't relate to this book in particular, but
no
to
problem.
The process. He says, I'm struggling through writing my first novel right now. How do you keep your faith to work every day?
Hello, James in Brooklyn. You're living in the right place. I understand there are more aspiring writers in Brooklyn than anywhere else in the world.
And a few successful ones.
Most certainly, yeah.
I had to move out of my old neighborhood when Martin Amis moved in, and I thought that the neighborhood was going down.
I shouldn't say anything in response to
that.
That
was just a joke, Martin, if you listen.
Right. James, just keep at it. Probably you're stuck because you don't know your characters well enough. Write a page of autobiography to yourself from the character in his or her own language about what else is going on in the book and about what they think about the following. God, sex, work, spirituality, and language, especially language, and just get a flesh the character out more. And what are their earlier memories? What are their childhood memories? What are their relationships like with the parents? These primal things that make us who we are. And I would venture to suggest that if you do that enough, then the log jam will unjam and you'll get on again. Good luck.
David Mitchell is our guest, the featured writer in this month's Leonard LoPage Show book club series, the book Cloud Atlas, which will be released as a major motion picture in just a week. The book is now available in paperback from Random House, and we'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas is the featured novel in this month's Leonard LoPage Show book club. It is now available in paperback from Random House. And as I said earlier, it is also about to be released as a major motion picture. Now, they say that the best source of material for a movie is a short story, because then you can expand. How the heck did they cram all of this stuff into a movie that didn't last 23 hours?
By disassembling it like Lego and then reassembling it in the shape of a film. There are some things in the book that aren't in the film, but unless you're going to go the whole hog and, as you say, make a kind of an HBO series out of it or something, or even a series of series, then some things would have to be left out. I think they've done a pretty magnificent job. It plays to the strengths of film as a medium, which is what I do when I write a novel. I play to the strengths of the novel as a vehicle for storytelling. They've changed the structure. It's not the palindromic structure we discussed earlier. This is more of a mosaic. So we're in each of the worlds for long enough for the hook to be sunk in. Then when all six hooks are in, it starts jumping about from world to world to world. And you kind of get an extra throb of pleasure at the ingenuity with which one scene ends. A question might be asked in 1850, and then the same question might be answered hundreds of years later in a different part of the world. I think they've done a great job.
Meanwhile, in the 19th century, and then in the 23rd century, something like that. Also, really three directors, or a directing team another director, who work in very different styles.
They do, and normally this could give you a dog's dinner of a film, I know, but here, because the worlds exist separately, it always makes sense to have different directors with different directorial approaches to depict the different worlds. It makes them more different. The diversity is actually a virtue rather than a defect in this context.
Tom Tykwer, who probably is best known for Run Lola Run, does three of the stories. And
he
then the Wachowskis, who are best known for The Matrix, do the others.
The Wachowskis did the stories that are furthest from the present. So they did the 1850s narrative, but also, as you would expect, the more sci-fi drenched part in future dystopian high-tech Korea, and also the far future, the post-apocalyptic Hawaii section, whereas Tom Tick for the German director did the worlds set closest to the present, so the 1930s, 1970s, and now.
I've spoken to a number of novelists who have explained their reaction to a movie as, well, I sold them the book, and they could do whatever they want with it. But I get the feeling that you actually gave this film your blessing.
Yeah.
You looked at the script first?
Yes, I did. I also, sort of that, the transaction that you mentioned there was also involved. I sold them the rights, but they were interested in my opinion on an early version of the script, and then we met in Cork about 3 years ago now, and they went through their ideas for it.
In Cork, because that's where you live.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, in the west of Ireland. And that was gracious of them. They didn't have to do that, but if I was able at any point to be a useful sounding board, then we'd talk on Skype. That said, I should say they are great writers. They didn't really need my help with the screenplay, and they did the script themselves. So I don't want to sort of market myself as any kind of a fourth Beatle in this outfit, because I wasn't.
Don't you have a cameo appearance here?
Yeah.
How quickly do you disappear?
After about three quarters of a second for the first one. If anyone's interested, then I'm in the future Korean section when the main character, who is a clone, is walking upstairs and I'm walking downstairs, and our eyes lock for an intense second or two. And then when the same character is, without giving away any spoilers, but is meeting an ultimate doom. I'm in the background, out of focus. But it's a good thing I don't have any lines to say. So I just appear there as a kind of Svengali background puppet master face.
But you're playing a number of parts, which is true of all of the members of the cast. Halle Berry, Tom Hanks, Hugh Grant. They are, I don't know how many different... They're playing different characters in every section?
Pretty much. And I think that's the really ingenious part of the director's adaptation, really.
Well, it ties it all together, doesn't it?
It does. The reincarnational motif in my book is really just that. It's just a motif. But in the book... Because the same face, even though it might be in a different gender or a different ethnicity, is appearing in the different worlds, it makes it explicit that these are the same souls just being reincarnated time and time again throughout the six worlds. And you can't do that in a book, because you can't have faces in a book.
But you have a comet-shaped recurring birthmark in some of the characters, which suggests... something, a reincarnation theme.
It does suggest that, but it only suggests it, whereas the film takes an idea, amplifies it, runs with it, and makes it a kind of a matrix of Pilgrim's Progresses, whereby each of the major characters has a sort of soul journey through time, from good to evil, from evil to good, more ambiguously in the middle somewhere, but it's a great thing they've done.
Well, if it isn't literal reincarnation, do you believe that what happened to someone on a far-flung Pacific island in the 18th or 19th century will shape the lives of people who live even hundreds of years from now? Is this kind of like the butterfly effect?
That's what I'm trying to evoke in the book. It's tricky to say yes on a live radio show, because then the obvious comeback would be, well, how?
It's going to show up on the internet, you know that.
But we exist in a medium of consequences, of causes and effect, and what happens to you is happening to you because they are the consequences of other people's actions, and what you do in turn, your acts will cause ripple effects, and you will have no inkling of where they might wash up, or whose lives they may end up altering in a small way or in a major way, but you can be sure they will somehow, somewhere.
Along these lines, one of our listeners, Luna from Trenton, asks, would I be wrong to read a love for, or at least strong interest in, the supernatural in your writing?
I just don't know, but I'm happy not knowing. And it's certainly it's a great source of richness for literature.
Does any of this come out of your experiences in Asia? You taught English in Japan.
Well, it is a part of the world in which it is more often taken for granted that there's some form of an afterlife than not, which you probably say about the whole Earth, really. Probably more people do believe in something after death than not. What that is and what you do about it and how you allow that to affect this one life that we do know for sure that we have because we're living it, that's another question. I don't know. Even if the idea of karma literally isn't true, I think it's quite a healthy principle to understand that things you do, your ethical position on questions will affect you and what comes back at you in your own life, in this life. I don't know what happens afterwards, of course, none of us do. No one comes back to tell us or emails from there.
But some people have written bestsellers telling us that they have gone there and come back. But
well, they have, and that's their prerogative in a land of free speech. But
you taught English in Japan, but also in Italy. Do you think that experience changed your view of language and of writing?
Yeah, I did spend most of my youth being in a country where I didn't speak fluently, being on a kind of language island that I'd have to colonise outwards from, language lesson by language lesson, experience by experience. So, there's a big, long, rambly answer, but we'll keep it short, so I think so.
A listener, Ellen, left this comment. She says, "This book totally blew me away and is one of the few books about which my book club was unanimously enthusiastic."
Thank you, Ellen.
Tell me which came first, the structure of the book, Cloud Atlas, or the authors and styles that you wanted to quote, that is, reflect, like Russell Hoban in the post-apocalyptic section?
Well spotted, Ellen, and thanks for the nice things you say about my writing in your question. Oddly enough, this is the only time it's ever happened, but the structure came first. As I said earlier, youthful impetuosity. I just wanted to see if it could be done, and if so, what it would look like. Having made that decision, however, I then needed, as I'm sure you can understand, to differentiate stylistically the sections of the novel from one another as much as I possibly could. And my ally in doing that was genre. So once I'd taken the decision to write a book with this wacky structure, I then had to make sure that the parts didn't kind of bleed into one another and resemble one another overly. So that's why I then cast around for styles as diverse as I possibly could, and yet still keep them all in the same book.
But could you write something that there's science fiction in the genre of Melville? Does the language of science fiction just so totally fit it that that we recognize immediately we're in that world?
Another deep question about the nature of genre here, Leonard.
I'm sorry.
No. It's fascinating, and for a dyed-in-the-wool word nerd like me, I could talk about this all day, but I'm aware we don't have all day. Briefly, I'd love to read a piece of science fiction written in the language of Melville. For my book, I make zones. I've got my Melville zone and my sci-fi zone, and borders between them. I'm interested in the borders, genre is a genre because it has certain tropes. You can play with them, invert them, subvert them, but they have to be there in some form or another. Otherwise, it's not that genre anymore.
Liz from Manhattan asks whether you have a mentor or had a mentor when you began your career.
Thank you, Liz. The British writer A.S. Byatt kind of took me under her wing a little bit early on, and actually gave me my first reading, probably the most nervous, terrifying experience of my life, which was a very gracious offer. And there's another British writer who's recently published, Lawrence Norfolk, who I'm going to have dinner with in London once a year, and he's been very gracious too in terms of giving me career advice, and we chew over the books we're working on at any one time in a safe and non-judgmental way. So I guess the two mentors would be those two. The other British writer, Kazuo Ishiguro, sometimes is also generous with his time, as he is to a number of younger writers, I find. We meet for dinner in London when I'm in town.
It's often pointed out that science fiction is as much about the present as it is about the future.
Oh, always. Yeah.
And in the stories about Sanmi 451, consumerism has taken over.
Yeah.
Advertisements are beamed onto the moon. Items are known by brand names. Coffee is Starbucks. Guns are Colts. Shoes are Nikes. Is that your worst nightmare imagined?
It happens anyway. At least in the UK, a vacuum cleaner would be more commonly called a Hoover. There's the verb to Amazon, as in I'll Amazon myself that DVD. Language is a playful, impish, mercurial, acquisitive beastie. And it draws from brand names as much as anywhere else. Of course, in the world I write, it has reached a point where the system of government is even called a corpocracy. It's happening, and corporations can be as powerful as sovereign governments in some cases. We have to be on guard, but again, this is a big, deep political conversation.
A listener in Lexington, Kentucky asks, I know that David is a patron of the British Stammering Association. Mm. I'm also an adult who stutters. I've recently been promoted and will be required to do more public speaking, and I was wondering if you had any advice on how to handle public speaking.
Well, you have a great organization here in the States called Stutter Talk, and I'm sure that's easily, you can easily access that online. They would have great advice for an American context. For me, it's just a lifelong relationship you evolve with the stammer. For me, the fact I can do this radio interview live now, when I was 13, it was simply unimaginable. That would have been the most nightmarish situation, because I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have gotten to the end of this sentence, and I really wouldn't have been here. Trick I found is to not view your stutter as an enemy that needs to be crushed, because you never will. It's a part of yourself, and it's not healthy to be in a state of civil war with yourself. And it will fight back anyway. You can't beat it. What you should do instead is to start viewing it as an informant, as a weird kind of ally. It makes you an expert in language. It vastly expands your vocabulary, because you need to know the roots around the stammer word that you can see in the mentally auto-cued sentences coming up.
If there are certain sounds that give you a hard time, especially in conjunction with other sounds, you restructure the sentence.
You can do. That's an extreme method. I would say I have a hard time with hard K's at the moment and words beginning with S. However, so as a last resort, yeah, you restructured the sentence. I don't really need to do that now.
Marilyn Monroe kind of changed the way she spoke. She spoke in that hushed voice as a strategy for getting past her stutter.
That works fine. Whatever gets you through the night, but stop viewing it as an enemy and start viewing it as an informant. It takes time, but another shout out, if I may, for Stutter Talk, who do a great job here in the States.
Well, you we've had you on the show twice to talk about novels. Mm. This one, of course, almost got you a Man Booker Award. Even getting close is pretty much an incredible accomplishment.
Well, thank you.
Are you working on another book?
Oh, yeah. I'm always working. I've got nothing else to do with my life, Leonard.
So when will you be back?
If you'll have me, Leonard, I would love to be sitting in this chair in about 18 months.
Meanwhile, you'll be introducing fiction of your own and stories of other writers performed by Campbell Scott, among others, tonight at 7:30 at Symphony Space.
Yeah.
As part of the Selected Shorts series. That's on 95th Street and Broadway. And if you want more information and tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. And thank you again for being on our show. David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, as I said earlier, Dave Eggers calls it a modern classic that no doubt is and should be read by any student of contemporary literature. It's available in paperback from Random House, and if you're too lazy to read it, there's always the movie that's opening up next week.
Thank you very much, Leonard.